Welcome to the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center's podcast. In this recording, join Matt Johnson, former senior partner at Simon Kucher & Partners, to learn the best way to form your pricing strategy. Here's Matt.
All right. Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure. The presentations here are always great and the energy is always great. Again, my name is Matt Johnson. I am sort of a hopeless pricing geek, my wife would say. She would put the hopeless in front. And my background, I started with a computer science and a history degree and not really a clear idea of what I wanted to do in life. Worked at IBM in their expert systems group about 30 years ago and kind of fell in love with the intersection of sort of big data before it had a name and analytics and computational kind of business decision making. And that led to a series of startups. I did three startups, one in the sort of airline pricing space that we were fortunate to be able to IPO. Another one in the business B2B space that we sold, and then more travel metasearch startup that was acquired by Kayak. Really loved the entrepreneurial space and quest for kind of being able to have a bigger impact. I ended up being a partner at Simon Kucher & Partners, which is a firm that does pricing for bigger companies, about 60% of the Fortune 500. And we would go out and really help companies figure out how to extract full price for their products. And I wrote a blog post about 4 years ago, relatively modest post that was called Monetize Early or Lose Late. And it was just sort of a little bit of almost a angsty. As an ex-entrepreneur, I have a very soft spot for the entrepreneur, the person who puts in the work. And despite being told that it won't work, actually builds something from nothing and delivers it and hopefully makes the world a better place or delivers value with what they're doing. What's frustrating to me is when that person at the end of the day, after having successfully delivered that, doesn't own as much of the end result as they could or should. And to me, one of the biggest factors, if not the biggest factor in that, is whether or not they figured out how quickly they figured out how to monetize what they're doing. Many times they're so focused on building the product that they're just happy anyone will buy it at any price. They're not really focused on maximizing that. But the reality is the value of your company is a function of how well you monetize it. But if you figure that out late, you're a VC's best friend because they love dysfunctional, you know, companies with great products that don't know how to make money at them. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit today. Over 30 years of going through pricing, I did become part of this. I actually brought these home about 15 years ago. My wife gave up on me entirely at that point. She thought I'd get over my pricing phase. Didn't happen. And one of the things I want to talk about, and I'm going to start sort of at a high level about why pricing matters and why it's not just sort of a topic of like $12.99. That first page had pricing, but it also had marketing, sales, product bundling. I'm really talking about all of value extraction. And SKP, over a number of years, they went out and actually interviewed over 3,000 companies. And 40% of the people they interviewed were CEOs, C-level people. And we asked them questions about their ability to extract full value. What we call pricing power was the ability for a company to capture the money it deserves for the value it delivers. Simple enough concept. And we had a whole series of things we rated them on, and we categorized them as either having high pricing power, like they do a good job of that, they have all the things to do it, versus poor pricing power or lower pricing power. And generally speaking, across industries, didn't matter whether they were commodity or not, there was roughly a third in most industries, from a quarter to half, but usually around a third that had high pricing power and two-thirds that didn't. So that was troubling right there, that for all the products that are out, these are big companies, these aren't even little startups. This isn't a problem that only startups have, it's actually a problem that companies have too, that companies, not all companies are able to capture full price for their product. So we looked at it a little bit closer. We said, all right, let's look at how they're differentiated. When we looked at the companies that had high pricing power, that did the things they needed to do to capture full price, they had 33% higher profits than their peers in the same industries, right? And if you talk about how those bigger companies get valued, it's a multiple of profit. So we're talking, it's actually not linear either. So a lot of times that would double their share price. So this is kind of a big deal. It's actually something that matters. And I didn't kind of make this up. It's actually something that the people who you would consider, and I think Warren Buffett's kind of the sage of knowing how to evaluate companies, one of their categories of things that they look at for every company they invest in is pricing power. And they won't invest in that company unless they see it as a company that has the power to extract full value. What good does it make to create a world-class product if you can't actually get paid for it, right? And he's actually obviously a pretty good track record. So the study also went out and looked at like, okay, what environment? Why is this only a quarter or a third of companies that are actually having pricing power? And 83% of the people reported increasing pricing pressure. You can imagine the transparency of pricing on the internet, the ability to source things overseas, the competitive little startups like you coming into the marketplace. Whatever the reason, there's tremendous or unprecedented pricing pressure in the marketplace today, that you to be able to defend full value gets harder and harder. 58% said they're in a price war, like actively going back and forth. Now, this is where it starts to fall apart a little bit, because I'm like, when we actually asked them a follow-up question, we said, well, who started that price war? 89% of all the companies said their competitors started the price war. And let's sit back and do the math a little bit. This starts to be like statistically impossible and points to the problem that it isn't necessarily a problem of there being a price war. It's like no one really understands the value of their products and they're trying to competitively price. And frankly, procurement, which is in another meeting, having a meeting about how to beat up pricing, break things apart, sell them for the lowest dollar, try and break apart value propositions to get things cheaper, is actually winning. I think the price war that's being won is between procurement and pricing people, not between companies trying to price their products against each other. The other one that's troubling is price implementation rate. So companies come up with what pricing they want to do. They push it out. And what this 37% means that if they asked for a $10 price increase to their product, on average, they get $3.70 across thousands of companies. That's painful, especially when, again, one of our following questions was, what do you usually tie your pricing to? They usually said some kind of price index, about 5% cost of kind of inflation index. Well, if you're pricing for inflation but only capturing 37% of that, you are literally systematically heading in a death spiral. And this is across 3,000 companies in all industries. So pricing is really troubling. And this is sort of a troubling space to be trying to do this. So we wanted to think this is sort of a negative outcome. We're like, well, how do you get past this? How do you fix this problem? And we asked them kind of, what are you doing to try and stem the blood loss in this kind of an exercise? And the number one thing was introducing new, innovative, differentiated products. This starts to sound like you guys, right? This is like launching new stuff, disruptive types of technologies, bringing new things to market for folks. Two-thirds of all companies said that, and that trend only has gone up over the last several years. Number two and three were about communicating value better and actually changing the customer's perception of value about our product. So, which gets back to pricing. So innovating new stuff and getting paid for it were the biggest things that these companies said they wanted to do to try and break away from sort of downward price trends. Can we get back to the negative a little bit? When we asked them, well, how do you guys do? How often, what percent of your products actually meet their profit targets? These new products, these innovative products that are your key, you're telling us, to actually launching, being successful, getting, you know, developing higher revenue. 72% of all products don't achieve their revenue target. That's kind of staggering. That's like 3/4 of everything doesn't meet its target. And 25% of companies said that all their products failed to meet their targets. So it's linked at big companies between the ability to actually generate something new and innovative, but then get paid for it, was completely broken, highly broken in the process. And I think it's important to dig into why. The other thing I'll mention is that those numbers aren't that much different than the success rate for startups. You know, you look at startups as an angel investor, you know, it's a little bit of a tough process because I invest in a lot of companies, knowing full and well that probably 3 or 4 out of 5 are going to die because they aren't going to do it. Now, why do those companies die? Do they not deliver their product? Most of the time they deliver their product. They deliver kind of what they intended. Most of the time those companies die, it's because they failed to figure out how to get someone to pay them for the product they were creating fast enough before the bills came due, right? I mean, they ran out of cash before they actually did it. So it ended up being a monetization failure much more often than an actual product failure. Tying this back to those companies with pricing power, we see that the companies that had that pricing power were 100% more likely to be monetizing their innovations when they came off the shelf. And the biggest differentiator was pricing got considered very, very early in the process. That actually stood out, that the companies that didn't have pricing power tended to think of pricing as the last thing you do before you ship the product out the door. And the companies that were doing better actually had a much higher monetization rate because they thought of pricing when they even first started to build the product at all. And the former CEO of Microsoft said, this thing called price is really, really important. So I think that a lot of people underthink it. You have a lot of companies that start, and the only difference between the ones that succeed and the ones that fail is that one figured out how to make money because they were deep thinking through the revenue, price, and business model. It's greatly unattended with generally. So I think he's absolutely nailed it. It's like, if you're not thinking about what people are going to buy or why they're going to buy your product before you build it, don't be surprised when you build it and they don't buy it. Sounds stupid. It sounds like actually painfully obvious, but it's the number of startups I talk to that are deep in the process, about to launch, and they're like, hey, we need to talk to you because we have to figure out how to price this. I'm like, oh man, that's like, like, oh, this could be ugly. One of the guys I really like, Peter Drucker, who's a more old-time business thinker, talked about customers don't buy products. They buy the benefits that these products and their suppliers offer them. So think about that. So if you're building a product and you haven't figured out what the benefits are the person's going to buy, why are you building the product? What product are you building? It becomes almost random whether or not what you build aligns with that. And then that's why I see, that's one of the reasons we see a lot of pivots for entrepreneurs too. They build a product, they launch, they try and sell it. Someone else wants to buy some piece of it because they really didn't quite have it right, and they pivot to kind of where the money goes. But think about how much energy they wasted in that initial phase if they had been more on track. It would be much easier to do that if they had nailed that proposition in the first place. So this gets to this concept of price before product. I'll kind of go from 10,000 feet down to more of the tactics. And this is sort of a concept that there was a book, Monetizing Innovation, one of my partner colleagues wrote that kind of captured this pretty well. I thought I'd make sure I gave him a plug here. But it's really about the process of systematically thinking about what you're going to actually charge. How are you going to extract value? And then building a product that optimally captures that value, that delivers that to the customer, and being less, having it be less hope and more certainty that you're going to get paid at the end of the day. And the book, and I like the way they broke it down, breaks it down into 9 sort of target areas, things you have to worry about to actually make that happen. First is have WTP as willingness to pay. Have the willingness to pay talk early. I am amazed at how reticent lots of entrepreneurs are to get out to their customer and talk about, what are you willing to pay for the solution I'm creating? It's like they feel guilty or they don't want to apologetic about having the conversation. First of all, the earlier you have it, the more likely the customer is to talk about it. When you wait until launch to talk to customers about pricing, they see it as the front end of a negotiation and they get very closed and they change the whole dialogue. If you have it while you're building it, you're saying, hey, I'm building a product. I'd like to make it something that's valuable to you. What would you want and what would you be willing to pay for it before I start? They're very often more than willing to talk to you about that in detail and where that money will come from and how they would pay it. But you have to have that talk very early, much earlier than most companies do. Segmentation, we'll talk about a little bit. Many companies build one product that's sort of monolithic to try and hit a market. And I have yet to see a market that is a segment of customers. It's multiple segments of customers that can behave very differently from each other. You have to understand that. You then have to package up a product, have the ability to land and expand, have an ability to address different segments of the market in terms of how you configure it. Have a monetization model, and this is really how you communicate value and how you structure your pricing in a way that's going to align with the value they're getting so you can extract the most of it. Picking a pricing strategy and some of the outside in business case, I probably won't get into as much. That's a little bit more of a mature company opportunity, which is probably less relevant to the entrepreneur side of things here. So I'll put that on hold for the day. Then value communication and behavioral pricing, like having great pricing, but then ineffectively communicating and setting the environment for that pricing discussion can make you fail, you know, before you even actually get to the conversation with the customer. And then maintaining your price integrity, again, over many price cycles, building kind of a brand pricing image is really important, but again, a little early in the stage for you guys. So I'm going to focus on the ones that are circled today, give a couple examples. So willing to pay talk early, I really believe in prioritization and focus. So many startups, when they go out, say, let's build as many features as we can. It's sort of the spaghetti chucking process and see which ones stick to our customers. And you end up building this thing that looks like a Swiss Army knife, hoping that somewhere in there is a tool that my customer needs and they'll pay for. Often that's based on, especially around here in the Silicon Valley, I find that many of these are very engineering-led types of exercises for consumer and B2B. And engineers generally believe that things that are harder to build should be worth more, and things that were easy to build should be worth less. And they kind of correlate those two things. I've done hundreds of studies with companies, spent millions of dollars with clients doing this, and I have yet to see any correlation between how hard something was to build and what customers are willing to pay for it. It's amazing. Sometimes you change the color and they'll pay twice as much. And so other times you do a massive transformation of the platform, like, okay, that's great, but I'm not paying for it because, you know, it just does the same thing it used to do. This is a case from a company where they went out and they were trying to add some things into their product. The number one thing that they were really excited about, because it was very tough, was this highlighting connections for Facebook. It was a company that's selling stuff online and they wanted to be able to tie it into, like, what are your friends buying? And is this something that your peers in Facebook are buying too? As sort of a way to validate it. And they were really hanging their hats that was going to be the key feature in this release. But they decided, let's just go out to the market and talk to them a little bit first so we can refine our thinking. Well, when they refined their thinking, they realized, you know, that the customers desperately wanted free ground shipping. It was a trivial, all it was just a changing of how they build for stuff effectively. It was kind of like what Amazon did or what eBay did. It was actually trivial to implement, but it was actually jumped off the page in terms of what they were willing to pay for it. taking away shipping as a problem to these companies, these small companies, was huge benefit for them. Communicating online with the seller over chat, trivial to implement, not that hard. In fact, in many cases, they had it, but they just didn't push it to the front of their website pages. They just had to advertise it more properly. 24/7 support is something that they provided, but not as an explicit service. Early access to special deals. You start to see some of these things, some of the things that were high on their development priorities turned out to be really low on their value priorities. And they were able to actually basically do kind of a full stop, reprioritize their development, develop early because some of the more complicated stuff they could just take out and actually increase their price at launch successfully. So that sounds like counterintuitive to like your econ course or something where you like do less and get paid more. But it happens all the time. Really, really understanding, refining all your energies on the things they're willing to pay for and the things that have the highest kind of bang for your buck development wise, because your time is really precious. Your engineering time, you know, the clock is burning. I've been there. You got a big red X on the calendar when the cash runs out. You better be building the right stuff, but you got to ask these questions or it won't happen. Asking about the price itself is tougher. When you talk about what are people willing to pay, I say that very casually, but there are ways to ask about price that are a little bit more sophisticated, easier for a customer to answer, and also easier to get meaningful information. If you ask, will you pay $12.99? They say yes. They say no. How do I interpret that? How many will they buy? It's very hard. This is one called Van Westendorp. It's one way to ask about pricing. And effectively, what you do is you go and you ask the customer, what would be an acceptable price for this product? You know, early on, if you saw this product, what would you be willing to pay for it? And they just give you top of mind answer. And then you ask them, what would you consider an expensive price? Like you'd be like, wow, that's a really expensive version of that product. And they give you a price. And you say, well, what would be a prohibitively expensive product? Like you wouldn't even like consider it in the consideration set. And they give you that price. When you actually plot these over a number, this is 20 or 30 customers that answered this question, you get a chart that looks something like this, where the green line is, you know, as you increase price, fewer and fewer people think it's acceptable. As you increase price, more and more people think it's expensive or prohibitively expensive. But you start to see kind of a sweet spot, right? You start to see, I don't think I have an actual pointer here, in the middle, kind of between $50 and $100, you see a sweet spot of pricing. And generally speaking, this is really your pricing range. This is your space. And most of the companies that we see that are launching products end up more towards the front end of this space, to the left-hand side of that of those two drops. And most of the companies, if you're looking for optimal price, if you have a mature product and you're trying to maximize profitability and balance volume versus profit, you're almost always going to be up against that right-hand ledge there in this process. So again, there's not a right answer, but it gives you a range to work in. It gives you a range of maybe what I put as my list price. What am I ready to negotiate down to? What am I going to optimize to? And communicate that in your organization and with sales more effectively. The other thing I would put on here is like, I mean, I went to business school, right? And I think pricing showed up as one of the four P's in my marketing course and as one chapter in microeconomics about price elasticity. And as I recall, the price elasticity graph was this nice straight line, right? They were volume and all that worked out. I don't see any straight lines on here. Pricing is not a straight line. Pricing has all kinds of other stuff going on here. Those drop-offs can be, if it's a consumer product, they can be kind of emotional price points, $50, $100. It could be the competition or the thing that they might switch to happens at those drop-offs. That could be where your competitors are priced. There's a number of things that this is showing kind of the aggregate impact of, and there is no little price curve. So I've also seen entrepreneurs that come to me and say, oh, well, we kind of have a sense of price elasticity, and so we're going to change price, and we think the sell volume is going to change. I'm like, no. If you have a straight line function in your little spreadsheet that's helping you model price elasticity, then you have not spent enough time talking to real human beings because they don't create real straight lines. But this kind of information is super helpful. I know a lot of the medical device companies I've seen do this kind of stuff routinely, mostly because they're more sophisticated as an industry about some pricing things. But it's actually easy to do. Most companies, again, if you're out early in the process, doing 20 or 30 interviews with customers where you ask them this kind of price ranging kinds of information can develop really interesting data that will help you a lot understand not only what the value of your product is, but how what your latitude might be to change prices. Once you've got a handle on kind of the willingness to pay, and you can break that down by feature, but the other thing you have to break it down to is by segment. Because you think about, I always use water as an example, right? If I go to a drinking fountain, I get it for free, chilled. It's one hand filtered, it's beautiful, right? But I'm willing to pay a dollar if you put it in a plastic bottle so I can carry it around. And if I'm desperate in my hotel room, I'm probably paying $4 or $5 to grab a bottle out of there to avoid my hangover the next morning or whatever. So it's, you know, there's clearly segmentation here. Water isn't water. This is water. It covers 70% of the earth. Huge differentiation in what people are willing to pay for it. And Most industries are like this. Anybody tells me, I've done this for, we did pricing differentiation for gravel. We did pricing differentiation for dirt. It turns out, you know, gravel, people are willing to pay. Sometimes gravel is going in someplace that's really low maintenance and they just want cheapest gravel they can get. Other times that gravel is one layer in a road. And if they don't get it delivered on time, the asphalt guy gets backed up and all of a sudden the entire project schedule is off and $1 million are incurred. So like the timing is that with dirt, it was about the logistics. You know, actually creating a big pile of dirt and getting rid of it and balancing out is actually a tremendous logistical feat and getting it delivered in time. So dirt was about the logistics that went with dirt. So everything has its value. Like what, and again, I go back to Drucker's. If you don't understand how people value it, not just for its, the procurement guys, the company's going to tell you, hey, it's dirt, man. Why are you charging me so much? Well, here's why. If you don't understand the six things that you're delivering besides that dirt, the expertise, the know-how, you will never get paid for it. You know, you'll be giving away your water for free in the fridge at the hotel. So thinking about that segmentation, the first thing I see people do is go out and do like a simple survey, right? They say, well, here's kind of the features of what we do. We've got a price we charge, service, delivery, performance, quality, some combination of features that could be, if it's a service or a product, different, obviously. And they could be literal features or also things like brand and other stuff. And they ask customers, yeah, how important are these? And you ask them to rank them. And you get a ranking and you say, okay, here we go. This looks kind of like that first graph I showed. Let's go. I said, but I think you run it, what you generally see is that everything's kind of important. We need all this stuff. You don't really see a lot of differentiation here. But if you start to actually look at the data from the customers and cluster it a little bit, either using literally like cluster analysis or even just eyeballing it, you can usually start to see groupings. You can start to break it up. And in this case, we're breaking it up not by the demographics of big, little, big, small, you know, big, medium, small, or by how much they're paying or things that are in like an ERP system, but like value. What do people value? What are the groups of people and how do they value my product differently? This is value-based segmentation. And what it boils down to is we often got down to these four categories. And there'll be always, obviously every product's a little bit different, but these are very common. One of them is like the company that wants the best. And especially for startups that are usually innovating and generating the next generation of things, this is really an important category. These are the people who appreciate what you're doing. They get it. They see the value in it. And they want the best regardless. And there are certain features that they care about. In this case, they care about service and performance and quality. Some people want it now. Can you make my problem go away tomorrow? You know, and that matters to them. More so, they'll take the 80% solution if it comes faster, right? These are the Amazon Prime people, you know, who want it now. And they have a different set. You can see that what they care about is substantially different. Some people only want the product. They don't really care about the services at all. They have a lot of internal capability. I just want you to give me the disc, call it myself. And they have a different set of things. And then there's a group of people, usually it's somewhere between 25, maybe between a quarter to a third of the people that are truly price only. So there are people in this world who don't give a crap about your product. They're going to buy the cheapest one. Their boss told them to buy one, said spend as little as you can. They're going to buy the cheapest one. And actually, ideally, you either want to have a product that caters to them but keeps them separate from the guys who are willing to pay for it, or you want to ignore them completely. The problem is that these procurement guys who are out there, especially if you're in the B2B space, or if you're online on sites that really highlight rank things by price first, you know, in a consumer world, you know, especially with procurement, their whole job, they get trained, systematically trained every 6 months to look like this guy. So what we see over and over when we do like work motion studies of how people get treated, although only a quarter or a third of people are want price only segment, 50 to 60% of people get treated as if they're want price only segment. Because it's in their best interest, especially in the negotiation phase, to look that way, right? You know, I don't care about any of the other stuff, just give me the cheapest price. That's the procurement guy's job. He's not the person who's probably even going to use the product. So the key here is really understanding what these segments are, being able to identify them so you don't let people fall into the price-only bucket. And you can actually say, well, I understand what you're saying, but your engineers have said they really want this level of SLA. They really want delivery in this time frame. They really want to be us to drop ship changes whenever they happen. Like, these are things that don't come with our really cheap version of our product. And be able to defend the pricing differentiation between different versions. It also begins to highlight how you might have to start thinking about, if I have one product and I want to capture the difference, which could be 2 or 3x from one end of the scale to the other in terms of value, I better have a way of identifying the specific features around, for instance, speed of delivery and extracting that and selling that as either an upgrade or as part of a particular bundle that's higher priced and using that as the anchor for the fence for price differentiation. Again, think about your airline tickets, right? Airlines did this early in the 80s where they looked at this, they did the same kind of exercise. They said, you know what? There's business travelers. They're not paying for their ticket. They don't care. They want to be part of the program. And there's college students who only care about price and want to take six stops. So how do we do this? Well, nonstops versus segments, or Saturday night stay, which was the big one for the business travelers. If you do a Saturday night stay, the ticket's half price. Everyone gets the rules, and it allowed them to differentiate prices by a dramatic amount on the plane, or 30-day advance purchase versus 12 versus 90-day versus 1 week advance purchase. They came up with the things that actually allowed them to nail these components. I think that's what most of the people here have to do to really understand how they can both extract full price, but then also differentiate, because you'll end up with price customers at a lot of different prices, and how do I justify that to those customers and make that a fair differentiation of price? This is the kind of data that helps you do that. Another example that we talk to people about is like how you charge is more important. People are very hung up on the number. I charge $99 for my product. And I would argue that that's the least important thing you should worry about. That will fall out at the end. The price is the answer, not the input. You need to think about how you charge. So this is an example from Michelin that I love. Michelin makes tires, right? So they tires in their marketplace for trucks. If you basically $99 is kind of a ceiling, like they all are in a range, but more than $99, no one sells anything. And they had a premium tire. Their current tire made about $99 in the marketplace. And they came up with new technology that mixes in the rubber that makes it last 20 to 25% longer. They're like, this makes these tires more valuable. You know, we should be able to charge $125 for them. But the reality in the marketplace is that the people who are buying these tires are paying cash out of pocket, some trucker. They're just not going to pay. They can't, won't, whatever, you know, emotionally are tied to $99 is the price anchored in the marketplace. And the CEO said, I will not launch this product. I really think it's a great product, but I'm not launching it and giving it away to the market price if I know it's going to go back down to $99. So they decided, he said, if you're going to do this, you're going to have to find a different way to sell tires. And so they went out and they said, all right, here's what we're going to do. For these tires, we're going to create a new program where you come in and Michelin basically basically you'll pay per mile for your tires. And when your tires run out, we'll just put new ones on, but you're going to pay per kilometer in this case for your tires. And they did that, and two things happened. That one was intended, one was unintended. The intended thing was they came up with a rate that got them their 25% increase, but they also, that rate, actually, they could set a rate that was the same as the $99. If you took a $99 tire and divided it by however long a tire lasts, that was their rate. They would naturally get paid the increase of 25% because the tire lasted longer, and therefore they got more than $99 for it with the new tire. So they actually found a way to create a new metric that captured them the value of their innovation. That was kind of the intended outcome, and it worked perfectly. The unintended outcome was that they really hadn't thought about. They'd been doing all this in spreadsheets. But a guy who runs a truck doesn't work in spreadsheets. He runs out of a checking account. Sometimes it has money, sometimes it doesn't. He doesn't get paid. He gets paid. He pays gas effectively by the mile that it goes. He gets paid for his freight by the mile. But his tires he has to pay all at once in cash up front. It says, and they're not big cash flow, they're a little business effectively. They're very cash flow sensitive. So by taking that out and saying, you basically can just sign up and only pay, effectively he's now only paying for tires as he's actually making money. So it's only some fraction of money that he's coming in. It's never out of pocket. They had a huge switch. They saw a 20% share shift in the market because this was sort of the unintended outcome in the market because it was so much more cash flow friendly to these small businesses to do business this way that the new model just crushed the old model. And because it was a unique way of doing business, it wasn't something that their competitors could immediately switch over to. And so it enabled them a really sustainable advantage for a very long time. And again, in this whole model, the prices of the product never changed. They still charge $99 for their existing tires. The rate they're charging is still the same rate per mile that it was back when it was a 99-cent tire, if you did the math. But by changing the structure and making it map better to how those customers actually consumed it and how their cash flows worked, they saw a huge increase. It's a common story, but it's like really thinking about my best experience with a lot of entrepreneurs is they tend to think about pricing as sort of like a pricing decision is sort of discrete. And they don't think, I often ask them, well, who's buying your product? Well, I don't know. It depends. Well, is it a CFO? Is it the COO? Is it the head of IT? Is it the head? Who's actually buying it? What is his budget? How does he get paid? Is it a CapEx budget or an OpEx budget? Like you start asking some of those questions and their head starts spinning. But that's really the same questions that these guys should have been asking or certainly ask more now that they've gone through this process of how do I make sure that my pricing not only achieves whatever price level I want, but is mapped and structured in a way that fits in my customer's world because I will get paid much better for that. Other thing you can think about is metrics and the metrics you pick and the difference they can have. This is an example that we had from working with one of the big sort of online sales platforms. And What we did was research. This was with a couple thousand customers, so it was a very big study. And we did a couple different models. We actually varied a number of things, but we said, look, for a $10 item, you have a number of ways that we can charge for that $10 item. And the reality is we're going to charge 50 cents. But we're going to charge 50 cents as a flat fee, or 5% of the $10 item, 50 cents, or 3.5% plus a 15-cent flat fee, 50 cents. Basically, every one of these answers is 50 cents. You know, what would you pick? And if customers are economically rational, there should be pretty flat, right? It should be just sort of, do you like vanilla, strawberry, or chocolate? Like, it's just sort of, yeah, there's some distribution and a few of each. It doesn't come out that way. For a $10 product, overwhelmingly, people want a 50-cent flat charge. Like, there's no spreadsheet that make any sense, right? This is how, which one is mapping back into the preference of the customer. So we said, okay, if you just did that and said, hey, that's a great idea. Let's go ahead with a 50-cent fee. But let's look again. Let's try this on a $200 item. Same platform, same type of customer base, but it's a $200 item you're selling. And again, we're going to charge, basically in this case, $10 any some way, some combination of either percent or fixed fee. We try it again, and again, one wins, but it's a different one. Because, you know, the guys who are actually selling bigger ticket items have a different preference. I would just say this is something that's really important to test. And it's one of those things that I think going out to customers and talking with them, most people model this. I see it modeled in Excel, and I love Excel. I'm the biggest, if I wasn't pricing geek, I'd be Excel geek, because they go pretty hand in hand, actually. It's a wonderful tool. But I think living in Excel, you can run into this fallacy that problem you're trying to solve is a purely economic driven, that the customers are sitting there with a spreadsheet at the other end figuring this out. They're not always. There's a lot of other factors. Just like that pricing curve wasn't straight, their economics are not straight and they don't match necessarily your economics. So asking a lot of questions about how they would pick these things, which models they would pick, you very quickly, even if you do that, this was a survey with thousands of people done very scientifically. I would guarantee if you went out there and asked 20 customers verbally and gave them some choices, that data would jump out of those interviews very quickly. But think about varying some of the variables that they're looking at. The size of what you're selling them, when you're selling them, are you asking them for a monthly or an annual subscription, a bunch of those kinds of things. And you'll very quickly start to see some of these truisms sort of bounce out. Another thing about communication. This is actually a client, and actually they were in the book, so I can talk about Smug. If anybody familiar with SmugMug photo sharing site, great site. If you like, it's absolutely, if you want your pictures to just jump off the page, SmugMug is a company to do it. They're a wonderful family-owned startup and have been very successful and have a great product, and they're very proud of it. And when engineers are proud of their product and engineers create a pricing page and there's a difference in price, they start at like $4 and goes up to like $25. Like, there's four plans, and like, why would I buy one plan versus the other? You know, sometimes you shouldn't let the developers who are excited about every single feature, you know, about their baby create the pricing page. Because what it did, it was, you know, they actually had a very successful business with a, you know, good profit margin. But when we looked at this page, I was like, holy smokes, like, why do I buy one versus the other? If I'm a customer, there was a study once that was done in consumer retail where a company, I think it was England, had about 24 different flavors of jam. And they would put together these end caps with all 24 flavors like a rainbow. And they had a bunch of sales and people would come up, but they didn't get quite as much sales for an end cap as they thought. And they took the 24 flavors and they put it down to four flavors and sales tripled. Because there's kind of a psychology with consumers that if you give them too many choices, they can get paralyzed. Carbonite, another one that talked about it. If you're familiar with Carbonite, they do online web stuff. It used to be when you went to their site, you'd go in, you'd select, oh, do you want 1 or 5 or 10 gigabytes or terabytes of backup storage? And do you want it this often or that often? And do you want, they asked all these series of questions, which are great for a technical person. Like, look at all the flexibility we give them. We said, whoa, your customers, like the dropout rates as people went through this process and realized how little they knew about what their actual backup needs were, was huge. We said, look, let's just package it up. Here's sort of the standard small business, you know, individual, here's standard. And by the way, you can click on another page and change it if you want, but let's give them a default. This is the best package for a person backing up their home computer. This is back. Their sales went up in the day they turned it on with a simplified version, 40%. Nothing changed. Pricing didn't change. Anything, we just simplified it. This is another example. We took that page and we created this page. Same pricing, same product, but just a clearer messaging as to what you should care about. And I think there's still one click away that we couldn't take it completely away from the developers over there, had a revolution. But the front page was this. You know, here's kind of what you should be thinking about. And why do I go from $3 to $5? Oh, it's because I get to personalize it. Why do I go from $5 to $12? Oh, I want to start selling them online. I need all those tools. Why do I go from $12 to $25? Because I actually want to market and promote and create, put this into my SEO and integrate it seamlessly. Okay, I get it. I'm that guy. Boom, bye. And Again, this is another company, didn't change anything. We didn't change the product. We didn't add any features. We didn't even change the pricing. We just simplified the page, and they got a double-digit increase in revenue from the site. And they actually saw upsell as well, because it was clear why people would want to go up to the next level. They saw both upsell and more sales and closed. And this is a small company. And when you add double-digit to sales, it sounds like that's kind of nice. You know, you add, you know, 10, 15, 20% to something, that's good. But it's all gravy, right? Their cost of sales is the same. Their overhead's the same. The system's the same. The cost, you know, a photo sharing thing isn't very expensive. Like, the variable costs are almost nothing. They literally doubled the profitability of the company by going from this page to that page. Now, think about how hard it is to do your entrepreneurship. All the stuff you go through, the 12 weeks you spend here, the work you do raising money, you do all that stuff. And if you're not spending the time to really nail this, the final mile here, you're potentially giving away half the profitability that matters to your valuation, which is how you, you know, establish what the value of your company and take capital and how much you have to give away in the case of an entrepreneurial fundraising. And I'm just amazed at how many of these pages are created between 8 and midnight on the night of a launch out of a lot of entrepreneurial types of startups. And it pains me because I think there's a tremendous amount of revenue spilled at the finish line. Some other irrational behavior to touch on, that this is a company that had kind of a good, better, best lineup, and they're making about $70 a user. A couple things here. One was that when we looked at it, usually in a good, better, best, you want to see sort of 40 or maybe 30, 60, 10. Like, or you want to see the meat of it's like in good, better, best, better is usually what you want to see the dominant. This had a very low end. Like, they're giving away a lot of stuff. And again, I see this a lot in startups where I want to make sure people buy. The concept of a customer coming and looking at my product and not buying it is so hard for a person who's worked so hard on their product to get away from, but giving away too much in the entry-level product is a common thing. That was one of our takeaways here, and we wanted to make sure we balanced this out a little bit so that we tried to upsell people better. So we did a couple things. One was we created a new platform at the top called Premium. All it really was adding a bunch of white glove service options and stuff. It actually didn't make any product change. It just like allowed us to create an anchor point of $299 at the top, which suddenly made our $99 made our other offering, the advanced $199, which was a price increase, much more attractive because it was not the highest price. Standard, we actually moved up to $99, and basic, we kept it $49, and we didn't change a lot of the features. And just by anchoring it higher and creating a better distribution of the pricing so that there were sort of logical steps, we saw a tremendous difference in terms of where people went. Again, the product hasn't changed. The offering hasn't changed. We just changed the pricing and how we structured the actual good, better, best and the relative relationship of the prices and how they were anchored at the top. And they saw a 36% increase in the ARPU per customer, and their MRR went up almost 30%. So it was like this huge increase, again, here right at the finish line by just tweaking kind of how it's presented to the customer at the end. Again, a lot of times prices are backed into like individually, like the basic customer sets their price and the middle price, like a lot of times those are different products or different segments of your company. And they aren't really thought about how they all interact with each other. Like, how do the relative prices of my different good, better, best impact each other? Cars are really good at this, actually. When they create a new package for a car, the demand that new package is generating is going to draw from some other packages that they would have bought otherwise. Maybe it generates a few new customers, but often it's going to create cross elasticity issues. But those are largely ignored by people. I found a lot of startups, especially in the technology startups, really understanding kind of how to make a good offering as a complete set of offerings is important, not just coming up with the right price for each of the segments. Because often these are different segments of customers, and so different people kind of have a point of view on what the price should be at each level. There's not often someone who kind of looks at the whole thing and makes sure it works together. Another example of anchoring, because I think it's a really important one, is anchoring is just about the common. It's about, you know, setting what is your price going to be compared to. So like if I'm buying something that was an editing, price editing, some editor for my thing, I'm going to look at Microsoft Office and use that as my anchor. Like, it's just, you know, what are you anchoring to? It can also be the high price that you offer or your competitor's price. All these things are anchors. And part of your pricing structure should be to position your product so that the anchors that apply to it are as beneficial to you as possible, or change it enough from the anchors you don't like can't get compared apples to apples. So in this case, this was The Economist. It's been a pretty well-described case, but I like it because it's so funny. You guys may have seen this back in the day. It's an older example. But they had a subscription copy. You could go get it in a subscription for $59, or you could get print and in a subscription for $125. And they roughly had 2/3 and 1/3 that purchased it that way, got about $80 a customer, and were losing money. And where actually The Economist, which is a wonderful magazine, was trying to figure out kind of how they were going to stay alive in the new world. So the consultants come in, and actually the consultants at the time, and we actually got fun of, like, you guys come in here, you do all this stuff, and you give us this, you know, this is your solution. And our solution was, hey, you know what? We're going to add a line for print subscription only. So it's $59 for The Economist subscription, $125 if you want to get print copies, or you can get both for $125, right? A lot of people looked at us like, how much did we pay you guys? This is kind of nuts. I said, no, this is going to work. Trust us. Well, in reality, you look at the difference. By anchoring that subscription was worth this much and then saying, hey, you can get this and you get digital for free. That's awesome. Again, there's no Excel involved in this decision for the consumer, but there was a massive shift to print and subscription and a massive difference to make Economist go from something, a near-death publisher, to a very, very successful, profitable publisher that's still around today. These little changes, I mean, I always say this because, again, you know, as hard as you work on the features and the physical things, the hard part of running your business, really exploring how to position it, how to anchor what you're doing, how to set the hooks for what the base price or how your customers should think about what your product is worth in the final pricing page is really critical and can make a profound difference in the outcomes. There are really three levers. We use this chart. There's a lot of different, you see this a lot in the accelerators around town, some version of this. You know, we're in the growth phase, all the ways you can grow your company, right? And there's really three components. There's how am I going to acquire customers? How am I getting in the door? How do I monetize them once they show up? And how do I keep them around so I don't have to get customers over and over? To the extent that they're sticky, I make more money. And each of these things actually are multiplicative, right? Doing all of them is actually more than just the sum of the parts. It's actually, they all multiply by each other. And cumulatively, those come out to revenue growth. And revenue growth is really what the value of your company is, right? How much revenue you make, how fast it's growing, and how much profit it generates are some factor in how people are going to perceive the value of your company, at least in later stages by the time you get to VCs. Early on as an angel investor, we're betting on the people and about other things as well. But fundamentally, this is the valuation as you get to the big chunks of your company you're going to have to give away to a VC if you want to grow. So the question is, from a pricing perspective, a lot of people then go and attack all these pieces, but I was just thinking from a pricing, some of the concepts that we've talked about, there's a number, the pricing affects these a little bit differently. So packaging that we talked about, how you structure your packaging and put it together, most directly hits acquisition and monetization. Those are the levers that it generally pulls. It doesn't affect retention so much. The pricing model you pick, things like the metrics that we talked about, or the actual way that you actually structure your pricing, use it as a subscription, as a fixed price, those kinds of things. Those kinds of models tend to be about both acquisition and retention, because now you're talking about how people are going to pay for this and renew over time. And then price level, the absolute price level you charge, again, it obviously impacts monetization, but then also retention is kind of this balance between, do we keep people around, or, you know, volume and price. This is the bottom one, is really the one that most people think of, and the price elasticity curve in business school is talking about. I would argue that actually the price packaging and model dominate this. The other is more just an outcome once you figure out the other two. But this is kind of the way we think about it and how it ties back into, again, some of the things. I've seen this, a similar slide to this in most incubators. We're kind of trying to help companies as mentors and accelerators, things like that, kind of think about their business and drive it. But often we don't tie that back into like the actual, what do you actually offer the customer and the pricing side of it. So hopefully this bring it together a little bit. So that is the core of my talk. Thank you very much.